Welcome to Packet Pushers. This is a show about data networking, and today we're going to take a bit of a left turn, and we're going to talk about data networking, but it's going to be involving storage. And the idea here is a lot of us that run networks are seeing convergence happen where we're carrying storage network on top of our traditional IP networks. And that storage often comes in two flavors. It's storage over IP, whether that's iSCSI or NFS, something like that. Or it could be FCOE, where it's not IP, but it's fiber channel frames wrapped in an Ethernet frame and then carried across our Ethernet switches. And I got a group of folks here who are going to talk about this topic, and let's go around the table and introduce ourselves one at a time. Most of you that know the show know me. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter, and a longtime host of the Packet Pushers podcast, along with Mr. Greg Farrow, who was out on the west coast of California today talking to us from a dodgy internet connection in his hotel. Greg, are you there, sir?
Hey, am I here? Hello, hello, hello. Is this thing on?
This thing's on. We can hear you, sir. We can hear you.
How are you, mate? I'm all right. You know, it's rather luscious to sit here and see sun, because I've been in England being washed away by miserable 0-degree rain and sleet. So it's nice to be here. And I'm looking forward to a week of being just outrageously nerdy. I've got meetings, presentations, discussions, and an inevitably large amount of alcohol to be.
Yeah, and I can tell you right now, your hotel internet connection is indeed dodgy, because you got right up to the word alcohol, at which point everything kind of spaced out and got all Skype crackly. Very appropriate.
I'm not certain that was the hotel. That might have been Greg.
may have been the boost talking already.
That was the barman delivering to my room.
And of course, Greg's out on the West Coast for the Networking Field Day 7 event, and I'll be right on his heels. I'm flying out there along with roughly a dozen other delegates that will be listening to vendor presentations in Silicon Valley, all of which will be simulcast and live streamed on the internet and archived as well. So I'm sure we'll be tweeting about that. And that other voice is getting more and more familiar, I think, to the listeners of Russ White. Russ, would you say hi, and how are things going for you, sir?
Hi, things are fine. I actually made it back from Nanog. I was pretty astounded, actually.
That you made it back? Well, this was with the Atlanta ice storm and all that stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. I was in Atlanta. There is a rule to never stay in a hotel with a, you know, like a Waffle House or that type of restaurant that shares the same parking lot. Well, unfortunately, I had to break the rule this week, and it was not pretty.
What was the most interesting talk you heard at Nanog, Russ, was what?
You mean barring mine?
Anyway. Barring yours.
Actually, the talk about data center power and cooling was really, really interesting. I didn't expect it to be as interesting as it was, but it was really interesting. There was also a panel, which unfortunately Mark didn't show up for, but it was called Help My Big Expensive Router is Really Big and Expensive. And it was actually really good having some of the providers talk about what it is they're looking for in routers and what they're facing in the data center space, particularly, and how to, you know, what they're working on. It was interesting because I saw Greg's post this week as well about that same sort of topic.
Nanog's one of those events I've been meaning to head to, and I haven't done that yet, but I got to make that trip at some point. It's a little different of a network focus than I typically have, which is more enterprise oriented. But as you pointed out, Russ, there's a lot of overlap now between enterprise and service provider networks, and I need to make the effort and go.
I read the presentation as well. I saw somebody posted out a link to it, and it's a great backwards and forwards between the the open. There's a lot of stuff going on about open source and everything should be free and simple. And, you know, why doesn't silicon chips just fall down in the next storm and give us free networking? And it was a great discussion between the Netflix, I want this and I can't have it. Why aren't you giving it to me? And then the Cisco guy stands up and says, here's why. Basically, because you want this, this, and this. And the only way to get that is if you actually have all these other things. And it was really quite a good discussion. Just so you know, Russ, we have an upcoming discussion with some hardware experts from some vendors and some customers who specialize in hardware design and testing. And I'm going to talk a lot about what happens in the heart of the silicon of inside a switch and a router. So people should stay tuned.
Well, let's talk to the other two guests that we've got around the microphone today. Chris Wall, no stranger to social media, has joined us. And Chris, you've been working on a book that's supposed to cover essentially anything networking related that folks running VMware might need to know.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on the show. And the thrust, I guess, because you use that word and I'm going to monopolize upon it, is that there's a lot of siloing out there, and the book kind of goes towards against fixing the silo where we have the network guys, the server guys. They typically don't know what one another's doing. And the book is kind of focused on, all right, well, how do I translate that specifically in a virtualized environment so that we can start understanding what's going on in the physical network, how that translates and impacts the virtual network, and how can we start shaking hands and rainbows and lollipops and all that good stuff.
Rainbows and lollipops, indeed. And of course, you blog over at wallnetwork.com. You want to spell that for folks?
Yeah, it's like the Shaver, WAHLnetwork.com, because they stole my internet website. So I was forced to get a wallnetwork.com. I always thought it was ironic. Instead of a .net, I made a .com out of it, so whatever.
There you go. And last but not least, joining us from Cisco is Dr. J. Michael Metz. And I don't know that you've been on the show before, Jay. Would you want to introduce yourself and tell folks a little bit about what you do at Cisco?
Sure. Yeah, no, this is my first time. I am popping my podcast cherry with you guys. Packet Pusher Podcast Popping Cherry. I like that. And yeah, my...
Is a podcast cherry a thing?
Wow. Hang on,
it's a thing now. I got to work that into the title of the show some way or another.
Popping the storage cherry.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so I'm a product manager for storage for the Nexus product line for Cisco. And so if it involves storage and putting data on a wire, storage networking, I should say, because apparently that's come up as a kind of a differentiating or distinctive factor for what I do. It's usually I've got my fingers in it somehow.
And you really are a doctor, as in you have a PhD.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that and 350 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
There you go. All right. Well, guys, let's get into the storage network design discussion. We've been going back and forth in email about this for some time, and this is something I've been wanting to get together and discuss for months, and due to scheduling challenges, we just couldn't quite pull it together, but here we are today. So let's just kick off with kind of an opinion question here. Which is this, convergence. In other words, how I introduced the show here, I was mentioning IP storage over Ethernet or maybe FCOE. Convergence for our storage, is that a trend or is that here to stay? And the contrast I'm making is there's still a lot of shops that are really into their fiber channel SANs, but convergence is coming along. So, Jay, why don't you kick us off with some opinion here? Is convergence here or here to stay or a trendy thing?
I got this Mike Myers thing going through my head right now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about converged networks. It's neither a convergence nor a network. Discuss. And it just... I think that it has hit a critical mass in certain areas. There are still going to be some areas which are probably going to be primarily separate. But in general, I think that what the trend seems to be pretty solid in terms of moving into, at least at the access layer, to have some sort of level of convergence where these underutilized links don't make a lot of sense to have an awful lot of wires coming out of the servers. So I think that generally speaking, at least in some levels, there's a it's hit that point of solidity.
Mr. Wall, as you're doing your some of your designs, which I realize you spend a lot of your life in the virtualization side of things, what are the trends that you're seeing? You do a lot of consulting and work with a lot of different customers.
I think it depends if we're talking single hop or multi hop, kind of like what Jay was talking about. If I were to kind of lick my thumb, stick in the air, see where the wind's blowing, I'm actually seeing more customers these days deploying things like FCOE, and in fact, deploying something like a multi-hop FCOE topology. Some of the advantages Jay were talking about come into play where you're able to do much fewer connections, upstream from your server to either the access layer, aggregation, whatever it may be. And that's pretty sexy because port counts, ports are expensive, SFPs are expensive, and trying to get that that consolidation is expensive. And really, one of the drivers that's helping move this in my ecosystem is that the CNAs, whether or not it's something like UCS with like a VIC or CNAs that go into a regular pizza box server, support the ability to flip back and forth between being iSCSI or FCOE. A lot of the storage arrays now are supporting native FCOE on their cards, so we can connect storage directly into an FCOE fabric. And when you have that kind of end-to-end 10 gig FCOE, it makes it more of an attractive packaging model to deploy into your infrastructure.
All right, so it's not really just a trend then. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to do it. There's cabling advantages. Are there cost advantage reasons to do this? And I guess let me put the question a different way. There are folks that are just love their Fiber Channel SANs. Oh my gosh, they are just, if you want to do any kind of serious storage, Fiber Channel is it, and they don't want to hear you talk about anything else. And I think that kind of lends itself to a natural progression to FCOE if you want to get the cabling advantages and using that underutilized bandwidth and so on. So is Fiber Channel really it? And if Fiber Channel is really it, whether that's traditional Fiber Channel or FCOE, maybe being bridged over to the legacy Fiber Channel SAN, where does that leave storage over IP? What's the play for that? Russ, you want to comment on that?
I know lots of data center design stuff I've been working in has been a lot about Fiber Channel over E, but it seems to me, from at least from somebody who's not in the FCOE market explicitly, that FCOE is very, very hard to get in a way that the storage people really want. You know, they want their zoning and they want other stuff, and there's not a lot of switches out there that support that yet. And the second thing that's kind of interesting to me about the FCOE market is I just wonder if, as much as we've heard about it, if you go back in history, there was a time, and maybe you remember this, Ethan and Greg, and maybe you don't, when we had MFM and RLL hard drives, right? Remember those? Anybody remember MFM?
You're going way back to the beginning for me, but yeah.
I did G=C800:5.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. And the big war between fiber MFM and RLL, right? And what actually happened at the end? This thing called IDE, right? Where the drive makers just kind of sucked everything into the drive and said, there's your eSATA. Now go have fun and stop arguing with me about your drive formats. I kind of wonder sometimes if that's not going to happen in the storage space as well, in the block and file storage space on the network side, and how that would impact the FCOE stuff.
I think the other thing that drives Fiber Channel today is something is that we still have things like Fiber Channel attached tape drives and Fiber Channel attached doohickeys that people are reluctant to throw out. Right?
I'm sorry, that's really funny. Yes.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to remember, but actually a lot of people are really attached to their tape drives. So I've had a real wake up recently where I was working on a 7 petabyte storage array, and the point that and I said, well, what about your tape backup? What do you do for that? He said, you can't back up 7 petabytes. And I said, oh, sure, yeah, you can put a tape drive in, you can get a backup out one. He said, you don't understand. It's not about backing it up. It's about restoring it. You can't restore 7 petabytes in less than 9 months.
Yeah.
And the problem is that today a lot of people are still doing Fiber Channel because they're still doing backups to tapes. The tape drives are housed in a tape library, and the library is attached to a Fiber Channel, and so the storage arrays can all access the tape library. And I mean, there's a bunch of things like this, and they're all attached because the tape library is one of the keys that locks Fiber Channel. And what Fiber Channel over Ethernet does is prevents you having to put Fiber Channel NICs into the server. That's really what Fiber Channel achieves in terms of the customers I've worked with, is that I now don't have to have 2 NICs for 10 gig Ethernet, 2 NICs for Fiber Channel. I can just use my 10 gig NICs to connect to the Fiber Channel tape drive, and that's about it. That's all it's good for me. But in the near future, we're talking about storage arrays that are so large that it's not possible to back them up to a tape drive because it's just not possible to restore them.
Jay, is that kind of the positioning you're seeing for FCOE? I mean, I know that's a really big topic and something that you work on a lot.
I'm still in shock that Greg said something positive about FCOE. I'm gobsmacked. I'm stunned. but no, I think he's spot on. There is a lot of of information and a lot of architectures that rely very heavily on these kinds of devices. And quite frankly, he's absolutely correct about where these things fit into play. I also want to point out that it was Chris, by the way, who said he's seeing more and more multi-hop deployments, so I didn't have to say it. But I think that realistically, we're getting to a point now where originally the religious war that dealt with protocols had to do with how much performance you can squeeze out of a low bandwidth wire. And originally that was 1 gig, iSCSI or 1 gig NFS versus 2 or 4 gig fiber channel, and fiber channel had the better performance and so on and so on. And now you're talking, 10, 40, 100 or the 32, 128 stuff that they're renouncing this very recently for fiber channel. And realistically, it's going to be less about squeezing out every ounce of performance and more about how easy it is to get access to the data and provision those connections from the starting point to the ending point, or the initiator to the target, or the storage array to the server. And you asked the question earlier, is there still room for IP-based storage? And my answer is not just yes, but hell yes. So I'm going to throw a bone to Greg and go on the other side here and say, yes, there's a lot of room for IP-based storage, because quite frankly, when it comes to extremely large and flexible deployments, especially with the movement towards software-defined storage, it's all IP-based. And so there's a lot of room for IP-based storage. I think that the future is going to lift all boats, whether it be block-based FCOE or fiber channel or IP-based NFS or iSCSI.
Well, let's talk about IP-based storage a bit and some of the design elements that go into that. And I kind of wanted to run through a laundry list of some of the different hardware bits and pieces that come up that network engineers that have run into trying to design, let's say, an iSCSI network, or a data network that will effectively support iSCSI may run into. And so I thought I'd just pick off one item at a time here and then kind of get the take from the group as far as the relative importance of these different features. And let's start off with one thing that's come up, which is switches that have larger buffers. I almost said switchers. Switches that have larger buffers. And this has come up in a context of, well, you got to be able to handle a burst of storage traffic that comes through because, my gosh, you can't drop any of that iSCSI traffic on the floor. So you need a bigger buffer in the switch architecture to be able to suck that up and make sure it can be delivered to where it needs to go. Is that really that big of a deal? And because there's going to be a lot of people listening on the podcast right now that are going, I just turned on iSCSI. I didn't buy any special switches.
Well, I think that if I may sort of lead off that particular conversation, I get a lot of questions about distance in my day-to-day job. So when we start talking about storage over Ethernet and contemplating what kind of distances we can achieve, the large buffers make a huge difference because of the way that especially the lossless traffic, and if you're trying to do lossless iSCSI or if you're trying to do lossless FCOE or whatever it is, those buffers make a huge difference in terms of what kind of distance you can achieve. Also, types of traffic, what kind of QoS you're looking to do, and how that is applied inside of the ASICs. So obviously, if you're looking at doing any kind of advanced networking, which goes beyond just a couple of rows inside of a data center or a few racks, you're going to need to pay particular attention to how you tweak those buffers. So I think it can make a huge difference if you're going to be doing something beyond just the traditional layer 2 switching that everybody knows and loves.
Get more specific when you talk about distances. What kinds of distances are you talking about?
Well, I mean, so in storage, and Greg's brought up the idea about the tape drives, and in fiber channel, it's not uncommon to have tape drives at a remote location. You're not actually talking about DCI or active data centers at that point, but you have a place where you're actually storing your fiber channel information, and it's technically off-site. And that can be anywhere from 10, 20, or 100 kilometers away or further. And if you're looking for true lossless capabilities, you can't really push Ethernet to a lossless distance very easily. And for example, in Fibre Channel, we can do lossless distance because of the crediting system for 500 kilometers or 1,000 kilometers, depending upon what speed you want to go to. In Ethernet, you don't have that luxury. Everything is receiver-based. So you have to have a large number of buffers or memory in your buffers to be able to receive traffic, and that prevents you from going, depending upon the ASIC, anywhere up to maybe 100 kilometers or less. So there's a huge difference between how these switches can handle distances and keep it at a lossless consideration.
So you're talking about lossless in the context of iSCSI, which actually I think goes back to a dinner that we had where we were talking about just how important is lossless iSCSI. Because from a practical standpoint, I can tell you there's one poor iSCSI network that I was dealing with where the line cards in a particular Catalyst 6500 were grossly oversubscribed. It was not the kind of a card that could handle that sort of thing. And I know there were a lot of out-discards on iSCSI ports, and yet I had no complaints from the storage administrators, even though I knew I was throwing frames on the floor fairly often, especially during high traffic loads. So is lossless iSCSI that critical of an element to design for?
Oh, well, if you're going to have iSCSI and you're going to put it into a lossless network, you have to design for lossless networks. And I think one of the things that's really missing from that particular conversation is what the true best practices for designing for lossless networks actually are. And most people don't understand that you hit the layer 2 pause frames long before you hit the TCP layer, which means that all the advantages you're going to get from the TCP session are completely eliminated if you start playing around with the pause frames at an oversubscribed level. We deal with oversubscription in Fibre Channel by having a predeterministic way of looking at the network. In iSCSI, the whole point about this, one of the advantages of it, is that, hey, I got an IP address. That's an IP address. I point the two of them together, and I'm done, right? That's the advantage for iSCSI. It's very simple to put together.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But what happens is that you don't have to understand the way the intervening network works once it's set up. I mean, you put together a dedicated VLAN, or back in the older days, you put together a dedicated switch for your iSCSI traffic, and boom, Bob's your uncle. But now you're actually having to count the bandwidth requirements at each stage along the way. And if you have iSCSI networks and normal day-to-day traffic that go beyond two or three switches, and a lot of people do because they have this kind of, well, we'll just create this Ethernet network, and the storage will get there the way it gets there, and I can have 100 or 200 to 1 oversubscription from my hosts to my targets. Well, we deal with 10 to 1 or 8 to 1 or 15 to 1 in Fibre Channel because of this problem, because of the way that you don't want to drop frames and you don't want to drop traffic. So people don't plan for the lossless part. They just say, oh, it's going to be faster because now I don't have that overhead. Well, that's not quite true, and people need to pay attention to the network more if you have a lossless network, not less, but more, even if you're doing iSCSI or NFS.
Can I just ask a question here? So if I was doing iSCSI on a single switch or maybe a pair, you know, redundant pair of switches, I wouldn't have an iSCSI problem in that configuration because I'm not going to get any loss across a single switch. And what I'm saying here is iSCSI storage array connected to a switch and all the servers connect to that switch. That's almost a lossless medium, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And where we have problems with iSCSI is when you're crossing a data center backbone. So let's say you've got a tree-based or a fat tree network infrastructure where there's congestion points and oversubscription. So a three-layered network model is, you know, at the edge you've got 10 gig ports, then you've got 20 gigs up to the access layer and maybe 40 gigs up to the core, you know, and you've got a fan out and you might have an oversubscription ratio of 20 to 1 there. You could have loss at any of those, or more, yeah. 200 to 1 is not impossible. If you're trying to run iSCSI across that, then this is where the loss becomes a problem. It's not so much where you have a single switch or, you know, in an SME environment, iSCSI out a single switch isn't a concern, I don't think. It's only when you scale up that you start to have these loss problems. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. No, absolutely true. And the thing is that that's the cautionary tale that I try to tell people, which is that, yes, lossless environments can help iSCSI and they can help NFS, especially in the environments you're talking about where you have a storage attached to the same switch as the servers. Mm-hmm. But the whole point about this is not – I mean, at that point, if you're talking about one switch anyway, are you really talking about a performance problem? I mean, realistically, I don't think so.
I'm trying to get at here is there are times, so many people will say to you, I'm not having a problem with iSCSI, therefore all this talk about loss is rubbish. But they're also using a 10-year-old model for building a storage network, which is to say, oh, I've got a dedicated network for my fiber channel storage, therefore I should have a dedicated network for my iSCSI. Mm. And in those situations, you don't have a loss problem, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you converge your iSCSI or your fiber channel over Ethernet or your NFS or your proprietary IP storage protocol, Gluster, Luster, Ceph, you know, whatever, when you converge those on the Ethernet backbone that's shared with everything else, this is when you get the loss problems because in the Ethernet infrastructure, especially if you're using trees, this doesn't apply in a CLOS or an ECMP backbone. You have these points at which congestion occurs. And so if you're not seeing it today and you're listening to us talk about it here, keep in mind that that might just be because that's your situation. Don't map your situation onto global warming as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Chris, are you much of an iSCSI fan one way or the other?
I've traditionally been very against iSCSI, but more because from a background perspective, VMware vSphere has been pretty atrocious when it comes to iSCSI prior to really version 5.1. There was so many iSCSI issues with the hypervisor that, in fact, when 5.0 was released, they actually had to pull iSCSI out for a period of time because it caused these really long reboot sessions. And so typically if I were going IP, I would go NFS, and if I needed to go block, I would go fiber channel. I'm not saying that I blame the protocol for that, but that's just been my history, why I tried to avoid it.
So when you deploy storage today, does that imply then that you're more of a fiber channel fan if you had your choice and were designing the storage? Or does that mean not iSCSI, but some other sort of IP storage would be your tool of choice?
Yeah, these days, if someone's running a more current version of the hypervisor, iSCSI is definitely back on the table. There's some storage arrays where I'm limited to just iSCSI. Fiber channel is becoming a little bit less of a use case for me. It's typically iSCSI or NFS these days, but that's just because from a vSphere perspective, those are the main two protocols. FCOE has kind of entered the realm a little bit later. And typically, it's a conversation that's much more difficult to have with someone because FCOE, I think it kind of has a bad rap. It kind of goes back to, I know we were at Storage Field A3 last year sometime, Jay, and even back then I was somewhat sour towards the idea, and that was less than a year ago, and now I'm much more warm up to it. So it takes a while to really say FCOE and not end it with a bleh, you know.
Well, I mean, I think maybe Greg probably had some alcohol to wash his mouth out after he started giving props to it.
No, I said it's the lesser of two evils. If I had to choose between putting NIC, Fiber Channel NICs into a server and perpetuate the ugliness that is Fiber Channel and going with Fiber Channel over Ethernet to attach to your legacy tape drives that are no longer needed, I'll take the lesser of two evils.
See, Greg, from you, that's a glowing recommendation.
So, Greg, you prefer IP-based storage then is what you're saying over the Fiber Channel of any type, basically.
My experience of fiber channel networks has been less than happy, and I'm talking about it from a business perspective. Let's put the technology aside here and look at the financial use case. The purpose of fiber channel over Ethernet really, in my opinion, was back when it was started, was about bringing – we shouldn't have multiple networks in the data center just to move storage around. We shouldn't have a fiber channel network and an Ethernet network to run IP over. We should just have one network where all storage and data – because storage – connecting to a storage array is no different from connecting to servers to the internet. It's all the same thing. And if you can remember back, say, 4 or 5 years ago, we had servers which had 12 NICs in them, IPMI, you know, DRAC. They had two fiber channel NICs. They had two data NICs for the VMware. Then the VMware needed another four NICs, one for each. You know, it was ridiculous, right? You know, so fiber channel over Ethernet was really about this process of converging the NICs down from 10 to 1 or 2, right? Mm-hmm. And then we tried to do it in hardware. We got blade servers that had these shared NICs that all the blades could share. But that kind of got expensive and kind of got complicated. So now we've gone back to individual 1RU servers is becoming far more fashionable with a pair of 10 gigs going into the backbone with IP storage. And the other thing that sort of sees the end of fiber channel for me is that storage arrays can't scale vertically infinitely. The cost of scaling storage arrays to 7 petabytes isn't doesn't work. You can't make a box and hold 7 petabytes of disk drives in it when it spans across 7 racks, because that's how many, much space 7 racks of 7 petabytes of disks is, right? So this whole concept of connecting to an array is a legacy idea. It will become a legacy idea going forward. The concept of connecting blade chassis to the network and sharing a fancy NIC, fancy fiber channel NIC, will go away, and the concept of having tape drives connected to fiber channel will go away. So what we should be doing is focusing on the future, not on the past. That's mainly where my beef comes from.
Okay, Greg. So let's back up a second. And so if I hear what you're saying that you think that as far as design goes, storage is going to be more spread out rather than more centralized. Is that what you're getting to, or?
So the solutions, it's still early in the alternatives. Like the network, I've just come from building a network, I said before, about the 7 petabytes. And the 7 petabyte stuff that we built took 7 racks and involved 810 gig ports. 410 gig ports to connect all of those things to the network. And I was able to build an ECMP network design which is one-to-one. That is, it's completely lossless. There are no oversubscription points in the infrastructure, because these distributed IP. Now, that IP storage array will grow to 12 petabytes later this year without any structural change to the system. Building 12 petabytes in a NetApp or an EMC is a very expensive proposition and not all that fast, because once you put that much data in a single unit, the I/O modules can't shift the data across the interface, because the when you've got that much data stored behind a single set of gateways, you actually have performance throttles. Now, most people in storage haven't thought of these issues yet because they haven't actually got to the petabyte or the multi-petabyte storage, but we're getting there. And so fiber channel over Ethernet gives us a manageable way to approach it. That's really where my thing about fiber channel comes in, is it's not the future. We need to move away from it.
Well, I mean, to that point, I agree with everything you just said. And I know, I think now it's his turn to be gobsmacked, but I agree with everything you just said. But it's also important to remember that, you know, along with those tape libraries, you know, storage is the most persistent aspect of the data center. We can change servers in a heartbeat, but the storage sticks, and it sticks for a very long time. And I think one of the things that people get hung up on in terms of the protocol is that they forget that the ability to have one interface that can connect to all the different storage types, whether it be fiber channel based or whether it be FCOE based or whether it be iSCSI based and so on and so on, is a huge plus. And now we have more servers accessing that data, because now we don't have to plan in advance which servers are going to connect to which storage array. And which it's most people actually forget about that now. It's like, oh, I have a blade server. I don't even think that I can't actually attach to any one particular type of storage. But now it's a lot easier to have any server connect to any type of storage and then move in the direction that's necessary for whatever application or whatever application development is underway. And I think that's one of the major things that are forgotten about, you know, the consolidation effort that FCOE brought into the table.
Let me bait the crowd with another topic here. You know, we got on that discussion when I introduced the idea, switches with larger buffers, do we need them, yes or no? And yes, for the circumstance of being able to go longer distances and so on came up. Now, another thing that comes up when network engineers are asked to do some provisioning related to storage is that of jumbo frames. It's kind of a perennial topic that comes and goes, and it seems to be, from what I've been hearing lately, that most folks really aren't seeing enough of a benefit from jumbo frames for them to be worth the trouble. The catch being, if you have a jumbo frame, if you're going to enable jumbo frames for a particular VLAN, let's say, you need to enable them on every switch in your infrastructure that carries that VLAN. If you don't do that, you are going to have connectivity problems. And so there's one aspect. But the benefit, of course, of jumbo frames is that you can carry a much bigger payload within an Ethernet frame. Traditionally, you'd have 1,500 bytes. Well, now you can go 9,000 bytes or higher, just depending on what your ASIC supports. Jumbo frames have somewhat fallen out of favor from a standpoint of the big benefit you get there is not so much, you don't have to do as many put as many frames out on the wire. You can carry a whole lot of data in a bigger frame, and therefore there's less processing that has to be done by the system sending that frame out the door. But with modern NICs that can offload that, it really kind of doesn't matter so much now if you're sending one 9,000-byte frame out the door or several 1,500-byte frames. And so is our jumbo frames really worth it? Is it really, you know, the quote-unquote, a best practice, which means different things to different people? Rust, what are you seeing in as far as trends with jumbo frames, and would you bother with them or not?
Well, I think you almost have to, fortunately or unfortunately. I think you almost have to deal with jumbo frames because, you know, from a storage perspective, particularly if you do FCOE, you're adding end caps, right? And so how do you get better storage throughput is you have to go to a larger frame format in some way. Now, it's pretty interesting that you bring it up, though, because jumbo frames is one of those things that the Cisco folks were talking about at NANOG as being an added cost in the entire silicon space, and how do you deal with those jumbo frames? And you know, you have to build silicon around it and push things that are bigger, and it adds things here and there. So it's interesting that you say that, but I don't think you can get around jumbo frames personally in any sort of data center design, especially when you start dealing with storage.
Chris, when you're setting up a storage, is jumbo frames on your laundry list of things that you want to make sure is done, or?
Yeah, it definitely depends heavily on the environment. And when we're talking FCOE, typically the equipment being used is refreshed enough or new enough that we're not going to have a lot of issues. You know, sometimes I'm working with a client and the switch can only support 4,000 MTU or something old that like that, and that obviously won't work. Being that most of the architectures around virtualization, we're typically using some kind of encapsulated method to send traffic for something else anyways, and we're going to need to go beyond 1500 MTU. So I typically try to introduce it when I can. It certainly in a 10 gig space doesn't seem to hurt. You know, I know when we talked about jumbo frames with 1 gig back in the day, there were certain situations where you could lose performance. Sometimes you could gain a little bit. With 10 gig, it seems to be a general performance increase, even if it's slight. You know, it's maybe 1-3% in some situations, as high as 10% in other situations. I try to enable it when possible. And when using storage to like a vSphere server or a virtualized server of some sort, typically we're not having to deal with, all right, I got to enable jumbos all the way to the core or all the way to some kind of edge device that is really difficult to do. We're typically doing the virtual switching infrastructure, whatever the NIC is on the server, maybe one or two switches along the way, and then we're at the storage array. So it's a lot less challenging than to get to something really exotic at the edge of the network.
Yeah, because you're only pushing the storage traffic at, you know, at the access layer and then hopping over to the fiber channel SAN, something like that.
Yeah, maybe access to aggregation, but we're rarely ever, you know, it's probably a poor design in general if it's hitting the core for some reason or it has some kind of really edge case need to do that. For the most part, it's, you know, we're hitting a 2K to a 5K, maybe to another 5K, and then we're there.
If you want to talk about iSCSI, I know in a number of architecture documents that you read from different storage vendors, jumbo frames is generally recommended as you should turn this on. And a lot of times there's not any much more background that goes into that. And then just to wrap a little more context around my insight into the question, I guess, would be that the performance benefit is so nominal, where you're seeing, you know, around 10% or maybe, you know, a little bit beyond 10% that you might get if you enable jumbo frames, you know, is it worth the headache? And some network engineers would argue no. They just don't want to fight having to have jumbo support on all the switches where it might be relevant.
I want to make a quick differentiation between the requirements for the two different protocols. FCOE requires roughly 2.5K frame sizes, static frame size. You can't get away with 1500, and anybody who puts in 9000 is wasting an awful lot of space. So it's a static frame size that is consistent across the board, but that's dedicated to a particular class of service. I thought we were talking about iSCSI or NFS, at which time you can have a lot more flexibility, but FCOE is kind of rigid, so we really don't mess with the FCOE frame sizes at all. But I agree with the it depends with the iSCSI and the NFS completely.
You know, you go back to this whole thing that you probably need jumbo frames anyway, right? So, I mean, discussing whether you need them for iSCSI or not is kind of like, I'm going to be putting them in because by the time I get VXLAN and Ethernet and I get, you know, 14 different types of NCAP that I've shoved things in IP packets or Ethernet packets, I'm going to be using jumbo frames anyway. I may not need the 9K size, but, you know, when you get, you're going to need something at any rate beyond what the standard is, it seems like to me from the start.
So here's a switch architecture question I have. Let's take like a Nexus 5548 or 5596 UP. And if I pump fiber channel over Ethernet frames through that thing, do I actually have to manually set a jumbo frame size, or is it automatically set up with the appropriate static frame size that I would need?
No, when you set up the feature for FCOE, it's automatically set for you.
Okay. Yeah, that was kind of my assumption. I remember having set up jumbo frames on the 5500 once. It seemed there was a global QoS class that you set up to enable it, but I don't remember anything particular for FCOE because we weren't running it on that specific switch. So what we're really talking about is there are multiple jumbo classes that can be established depending on what kind of a frame it is that's going through the switch.
Yeah. With FCOE, basically the way that the architectures are from the 5K to the 7K, there's a slight difference in the size of the frame, but it's negotiated automatically behind the scenes, and nobody really needs to go in and make any changes to it.
Yeah, it's actually somewhat disarming when you first look at a switch that's configured because you're looking for like a system MTU value or something, and really once you do that feature FCOE, it's all taken care of. You don't have to worry about it.
Let's move into QoS then, since we keep going down this road, and we've been having an interesting parallel discussion with FCOE and IP storage. So when we get into QoS, let's start with IP storage, you know, first of all. Let's talk about iSCSI, NFS, that kind of thing. What is an appropriate QoS scheme, and at what points in the network do you need to apply it, and for what reasons? What are we trying to accomplish with a QoS policy for IP storage?
Well, I think it goes back to what Jay was talking about before, which is you're trying to get, you know, as close to lossless as you can. So you're looking at the buffering and how big of a buffer you have in the switch and how you prioritize that traffic. I mean, I think the biggest issue you're going to run into there is if you're doing something in a data center that has streaming stuff anyway, then you're going to end up with this priority situation where you're trying to manage FCOE or iSCSI or whatever it is at layer 2 and your storage QoS, but you've also got this streaming video or streaming audio that you've got to deal with that needs to be prioritized as well. So that's where you get into challenges from a QoS perspective on a converged infrastructure. I won't say it's not possible to do. It's just, you know, a little more challenging from a queuing perspective, and you have to think about what you're going to do with those things.
Well, whereas streaming traffic is very intolerant of a lot of delay, you can't have streaming traffic sitting around in a buffer for very long without impacting the, you know, the end user experience. How tolerant, conversely, is storage traffic? If I've got iSCSI packets sitting around in a queue for a while, how tolerant is that? Because, of course, the buffer bloat problem across the internet is you have packets sitting around in a queue for so long that, they end up getting delivered eventually, but not before TCP decided they didn't get delivered and is doing retransmissions, you know, just making the problem worse.
Well, I would actually be cautious to say it's just a matter of how much will it tolerate. I mean, you start thinking about voice over IP and how long can you actually tolerate for jitter and delay before you drop the call. I mean, sure, you get into that with storage, but it's also going to impact the way the applications interact with the storage device itself, particularly in block storage. You know, a lot of these applications now, if you're looking at a web server and the front end is a web front end and you've got a back end process that's queued or something like that where you're actually doing some sort of a mechanism to talk between the back end and the front end, and then the back end is talking to a database, you've already got two hops application wise in there in terms of delay and jitter for the end user's experience. So if you start doing a lot of high-scale buffering in your switches, you know, to manage storage, then you could end up in a situation where you're actually impacting the user experience, even though you're not, you know, you're not actually dropping packets per se. You're just impacting the way the application actually works. So I think it's kind of application dependent in those situations, and you've got to think about what applications you're going to be running in the data center and how it's going to work.
Well, it also depends on where things fit. I mean, for example, you know, different types of switches have different forwarding mechanisms internally.
Right.
And so, yeah. So if you've got, let's just, I mean, I'm familiar with Cisco switches, so, you know, so sue me. And we've got a couple of different types of ways that we move data across the backplane. In certain switches, there's no oversubscription across the backplane. We're just throwing bandwidth at the problem, and there's no queuing. In some switches, we have an arbiter, which actually identifies the correct virtual output queue to send data out. And I know, I believe Greg's actually written about this in the past. So if, depending upon the switch, the buffering is important. But then again, if you have something like a fabric extender, which is not a switch per se, but rather a remote line card for a switch, you know, those buffers are very important because now you have a guaranteed oversubscription to a parent switch. So it's going to make a big difference as to how these things are actually passed from one device to another or even across the backplane of an individual device. And so with storage in particular, the way – and I can only speak, like I said, for the way that we do it because I don't have the background in other switches on the Ethernet side. To be able to understand that if I'm going to be sending an IP – a packet for storage, and it's in its own class of service, and I've applied an ETS value to that class of service, and it's going to get a guaranteed percentage of bandwidth. Then, and let's say, for example, I've got 10% iSCSI, I've got 40% FCOE, and the rest is the Ethernet LAN, and they're all ascribed to specific QoS types. Those are minimum guarantees, and those minimum guarantees mean that we're going to in some cases, pause the traffic for FCOE or hold traffic for the Ethernet so that the iSCSI can make sure it gets its 10%. But everybody's got its own minimum guarantee. And if it's not a full link, anybody can send whatever they want, right? So there really isn't as much contention once the QoS is set up properly based upon, you know, the class of service for whether it be lossless iSCSI or lossless FCOE or what have you. But again, I'm not speaking generally. I'm just speaking from what I know about from my own experience with the Cisco switches.
This is one of these points where jumbo frames comes back in too, because when you enable jumbo frames on a network, you radically change the buffering because now you've got a 4,000-byte frame sitting behind a 64-byte frame, and that can change the QoS profile very dramatically. So a lot of people who've done jumbo frames, in my experience at 1 gig, will get very little benefit because the buffering in the switches doesn't – you've got this lumpiness in the QoS. But when you get to 10 gigs, this starts to smooth out because the transmission lag – now, this assumes that you've got 10 gig everywhere, right – actually goes away. And so for jumbo frames, it's a very different discussion for QoS because the transmission on the Ethernet is actually made of a memory, and it's usually chunked up into 1,500-byte payloads. And if you start transmitting 9,000 bytes, those memory buffers get re-architected to handle that. And their buffers actually shrink. They can actually hold less packets in older switches. So the advice I can give you for QoS is always have new switches if you're going to do storage, and always, if you're going to do jumbo frames, have newer switches doing 10 gig because that's when the performance really kicks in.
Now, on newer switches that are doing FCOE, there is a standard called data center bridging, which has a lot of subcomponents to it that deal with traffic prioritization and making it so that fiber channel over Ethernet frames are going to be delivered and delivered in an appropriate way. Jay, did you want to talk a little bit about data center bridging? You kind of alluded to it, I think, earlier.
Yeah, and thank you, by the way, for presenting it that, because a lot of times people will say, oh, DCB means lossless, and lossless is just one of the many things that's in there. So thank you for making that distinction. Realistically, for the purpose of storage, there's really only three that are directly affecting FCOE. And one we've already talked about, and that's the pause frames and the what's called priority flow control, which is what allows us to put pause frames on specific class of service values, as opposed to blocking the entire link. And then the other one I mentioned earlier, which is enhanced transmission selection, which is kind of a fancy name for bandwidth sharing. And then the third part of it, which is also part of the ETS document, is how the devices talk to each other, or DCBX, you know, data center bridging exchange. And those three things combined are what make up the bulk of enhanced Ethernet storage services.
And for those that I guess, like myself, that didn't learn this through networking. If you've ever worked with like Cisco UCS and you've gone to the QoS settings in your LAN tab, you're basically seeing PFC, ETS, et cetera, right there when you can weight the different classes of service. So it's kind of the way we can translate this back into the server world, I suppose.
All right, so let's move into a little bit different part of the discussion here. One of the things I am a fan of, and more so as I continue to work on different IT teams, is getting the different silos to communicate with one another. And I've been a, I don't want to say a victim exactly, but I've found myself in a situation very often where I hear that, oh yes, we just spent $1 million on storage and it's coming in on the dock next week. And I go, oh, is there a design for that? Oh yeah, we're just gonna plug it into the network. You know, there was no discussion, there was no plan. You know,
sounds like a solid design.
Look at those NetApp arrays, aren't they shiny? Well, how are we gonna plumb those up? Well, the engineer just said we're just gonna plug them in, and I'm supposed to ask you for, you know, 16 Ethernet ports. Oh, okay, hope it works out for you, kind of thing. So I really have found some very productive conversations in sitting down with the folks that are involved in storage or virtualization or whatever the other IT discipline is and say, what are you trying to do? And what are the important characteristics of this traffic to you or to this application for you? And then let's work on designing this whole thing as a unified system together. So let's apply that logic to storage here. Again, I've been in a situation where some centralized storage array gets kind of designed in a vacuum, or should I say not designed, and there's no input from the networking team. What kind of questions should storage engineers be asking network engineers and maybe vice versa? Chris, you're probably a good person to start off with this.
Yeah, so I'll kind of flip it on its head as well, because I've seen it kind of go the other way, where the storage team deploys something and the network team also is just completely clueless about things like zoning and how to build an FCOE fabric. So in this case, we have a storage team that wants to deploy a piece of storage. They bought it, then, oh, it comes with FCOE cards. That's great. Well, we know that we have 10 gig network. Let's just plug this bad boy in. And oh, by the way, no one knows how to zone this thing. So hey, network team, you're just doing this after the fact. So I think one critical piece of this discussion that doesn't go away when you do FCOE is you still have to zone in a multi-hop environment, especially. There's still a zoning creation necessary. So if you're going to work in that kind of environment, the network and storage team have to work together. Because in this one example that I have off the top of my head, the network team was basically Googling how to build a fabric and had zoned all the initiators together. And they were scratching their head because anytime someone made a change to the switch, the state change notifications would fire out like crazy and all of their vSphere hosts would purple screen because of just all this failure to talk to storage. So it's absolutely critical to work amongst each other, or else you're going to get even the third team that we kind of didn't mention, the server team involved, because their stuff's going to crash. So I think it's a big idea to talk about how you're going to zone all this stuff together.
Jay, did you have anything to add to that?
Layer 8's issues are always the biggest to deal with. and it goes back to the question that we had earlier about, you know, what's with the future of Fibre Channel, what's with the future of IP storage. And the reality is that the easiest thing to solve in the data center, it seems to me, is the technological problems. I mean, the technology will eventually be able to solve whatever problems as long as people are willing to think about how to address issues. Communication, on the other hand, is the one thing that people would love to not have to deal with. So we had we all talk to customers on a regular basis. So there's, you know, we're not really, we're not presenting anything that anybody doesn't already know. But I was with a customer a couple weeks ago who really wanted to bend over backwards and try to get equipment made that does not exist right now, because they are perfectly happy with going with FCOE from the server to the storage, but they don't want to share the link with the network guys. And I'm looking at them going, okay, you realize you've got 12 different manufacturers of servers and you want me to create hardware to go into all these 12 different servers so that you don't have to talk to your network guys? Yeah, that's basically what they're talking about.
Oh my.
And And I get those conversations a lot, and the reality is that I will look them in the eye and say, this is not the technology for you. You know, what you're looking for is, you know, to stave off having a conversation with somebody that makes you feel uncomfortable. And as long as they can place the blame on, you know, a vendor because they don't have the right, you know, hardware manufacturing, there's no need to sit down with the guy across the hall. And that's going to be the biggest issue. So when I talk to, I mean, I do a lot of presentations to network engineers, and I have to sit down with them and I say, look, guys, when you talk to a storage person, there's one thing you have to keep in mind and that drives everything he does, and that's paranoia. And they laugh and they kind of giggle amongst themselves. I'm like, no, really, it's paranoia. And the reality is that in a storage world and in a storage environment, if you lose data on the wire or in the array, people can go to jail. People will have to go in front of SEC committees. People have to go in front of Congress. It's or whatever government agency that they're responsible for. Bad things can happen personally to them, and so they're going to be the most conservative people in the group. And so when you, as a network guy, say, "Well, we'll just fail over to SAN-B." That sends them into conniption fits because that plan has to take months to prepare for. You can't just simply make it happen. And that predeterministic mindset just simply does not exist on a regular basis with the networking guys. So it's a cultural war more than anything else, I think, that prevents a lot of technology that could solve business problems from actually happening.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to – I kind of thought of it, so I'll bring it up. But in an iSCSI implementation, you know, as a storage person, you're going to deploy an iSCSI storage array in some sort. It's typically okay to tell your network team, you know, I just need some links. And they'll typically bond those links together using LACP. This is one of those things you need to really communicate the fact that you need if you're deploying FCOE from the storage array, not to use LACP, not to actually bond – or link aggregation group form those interfaces to the FCOE storage, just because you really can't do that with one virtual FC interface. So this is one of those situations where it wasn't really communicated clearly from the storage team to the network team what they were trying to do. They formed an LACP lag to the storage. It wouldn't work, and lo and behold, it ended up being they just didn't really follow the instructions on how to create VFCs and bind those. So I think it just underlines how important it is to really sit down and communicate what the differences are between things like iSCSI and FCOE, what your intentions for this particular connection is from your storage array up to the networking, you know, infrastructure, and make sure that both teams understand. You know, network guys may not understand what building a fabric is all about. The storage guys may not understand what the whole point is behind LACP and things like that. So it really underlines the importance of opening those channels of communication, or else you spend a couple weeks spinning your wheels, calling support, opening, you know, SEV3 tickets, whatever it may be, when it's like, oh, it was four command lines that I goofed up on a switch and everyone looks kind of stupid.
Well, I have had that experience where it can be an awkward or uncomfortable conversation, but once you get through the awkward part of it, you're really talking to a peer and you both just have different areas of expertise. And once you're comfortable with each other having that conversation, or maybe it's a group of you and there's kind of a trust that's formed there, all of a sudden the whiteboard gets real active and people start throwing ideas back and forth and trying to understand what the other one does. And the end product is so much better. I'll go back to an example I had of designing a fairly simple setup with a Blade server going to a virtual port channel pair of Nexus 5500s. We had three different iterations of how we were going to do those uplinks and what we ended up settling on because the understanding that the guy running the Blade Center had with what the network was doing versus the understanding I had with what his Blade Center were doing. We were both wrong about each other's stuff. Both of our assumptions were wrong. I was assuming he could do LACP. I can, but it's got to be like this. And he said, well, I want to plumb all this to this one switch and this other side to the other switch. Well, no, wait a minute. Think of this as one big switch. It's a virtual port channel a pair here. And he went, oh, and as soon as the light went on in his head about that, it changed how we wanted to do the plumbing and what made sense. So actually, let me ask a practical question related to this here. When it comes to storage traffic, and I guess this is kind of, again, the two-sided question, FCOE versus IP storage, but how critical is fast failover? And let's talk specifically about either losing a switch that's in path or losing a link that's in path. How fast is fast enough to fail that traffic, in-flight traffic, over to some other path? Russ?
Again, it goes back to your applications and what it is you're trying to do in the data center. But typically speaking, nowadays, it's really, really important to have it very quick, because most applications now don't tolerate the type of downtime that you're dealing with, you know, with a switch type failover or something like that. We're talking, instead of milliseconds of convergence, you're talking about how many packets do you drop during convergence, type of convergence speeds.
Yeah. So in other words, you know, if a link goes down, you need to have infrastructure configured such that
you switch over as quickly as possible, because drop packets are a bad thing.
That's kind of the sexiness with things like iSCSI, FCOE, et cetera, is because they are path aware and they are building actual fabrics. Typically, it's as long as I know that one of my paths to storage has failed, it's not detrimental. And there's other considerations I would place on that too. Things like maybe the edge itself, we don't have fast fail because I want to actually understand that I have different paths to my upstream, you know, that I have one going one way, one going a different way. If that is failing, it's going to be a link down issue or something like that. It's not too critical, but within the middle somewhere, I want to know pretty quickly. So typically at the edge, I'm not using something like link aggregation because from a storage perspective with FCOE, I can't. With iSCSI, I typically can. But in the middle guts there, I want to make sure that the traffic is being rerouted as transparently as possible. And in fact, I had one situation where a customer was running a type of CNA that had like a 30-second failure time on each port. And we're talking four ports or four paths to storage, so it was 2 minutes before all the active paths died and the Lua kicked in and it went over to the other side of the fabric. And 2 minutes is... I mean, it might as well be 10 years to an application.
It's a long time.
And in fact, there was a lot of Linux workloads there that, because it couldn't write to storage and couldn't hear from storage in such a long time, it switched all the partitions to read only. And Windows was fine. It tends to have a lot more. It's a little more fuzzy about how long it takes to receive information from disk. But Linux specifically said, you know what? I want to ensure quality on my operating system level. It wasn't even the application at that point. After a certain period of time, it just went read-only.
Yeah. So I think the center versus edge point is a very good point, because if I'm directly connected to the storage, you know, the storage box is directly connected to the port, then that's fine. You know, I should be able to see it pretty quickly. But in the center of your network is where you really need to think about, you know, like the micro loops and the fast down detection, and either reporting it quickly so the edge device knows about it, or doing something to make sure that you're really, really quick in your failover, you know, and going, say, between the TOR and the spine, or first level spine and second level spine in a pretty typical class design.
Right, because most of the time the storage array, it's sending sense codes, SCSI sense codes all the time. So for those kind of edge type issues, I'm typically going to know about it because the array is telling me. It's definitely that gooey Oreo cream center that I'm more worried about.
Yeah, yeah.
The Oreo cream center, I love it. Well, now, Chris, you were also talking about some intelligence that iSCSI has to be able to determine, in a multipath way that some path is no longer there. Are you talking about MPIO or something else?
Yeah, basically, you know, in the VMware realm, we're using native multipathing, which could be, you know, most recently used fixed path, Alua, that kind of thing. But it's the fact that we're not trying to hide the fact that I'm taking different ways to get to the storage, which is completely different in NFS, where you only have the session can only take one path. It doesn't have the idea of pathing in that case. It's just handing it off to TCP and the other layers in the OSA model and saying, take care of this. I don't know how to get there.
Yeah, some other storage arrays that I've dealt with, I'm trying to remember the manufacturer now, but the scheme was not to do link aggregation at all, but was to plumb individual 10-gig interfaces, each with its own IP address, and all the redundancy and path magic happened at a higher level. It happened above the network. effectively the array would detect I've lost a NIC or I can no longer contact this particular IP address, and therefore take it out of the calculations, and the remaining traffic would settle in some load-balanced way across the interfaces that were remaining. And I right. didn't have to do anything from a network perspective, no LACP, no nothing, just plummet, give it an IP address, drop in the right VLAN. You know, from a connectivity perspective, I mean, that's all that was required, which again underscores the point. You got to talk to the storage guy's network team and vice versa to figure out what's really going on under the hood to plumb things appropriately.
Right.
Absolutely.
And Ethan, the other thing is that, you know, even when you talk about Ethernet, you're talking about straight Ethernet. But in today's data center, quite often we're driving layer three to the edge and we're pushing Ethernet on top of it. So now all of a sudden things get a lot more interesting from an FCOE perspective or just straight from iSCSI and stuff like that, right? If you're carrying IP over an MPLS core or something like that because you're running some sort of an overlay network on top of a Tor on top, you know, a double layer of control planes, all of a sudden you have shared risk groups and you have all sorts of weird things that you've got to start thinking about.
Absolutely. I think the communication, and I've hit a very similar situation what you're talking about, where typically it's called a VIF, virtual interface, or a LIF, logical interface, where the storage array is responsible for moving its VIF or LIF around. And we don't want, I mean, typically you see Ethernet connections coming out of something, you want to form a lag. It has higher, faster convergence time, et cetera, et cetera. And so in those cases, it's like, you know, a slap on the hand, like, no lag. Please just give me straight plumbed pipes.
I got slapped on the hand for sure. No, we want to do LSP. No, we don't. Really? I want to talk to the engineer.
Yeah.
I'll add one small thing here. The other way to do things too is to actually, if you're at a net, of a data center of a certain size, it's possible to have two networks. So for example, one of the things I've done at a very high level in the organization is say, over here is a test network or a development network. And in there, we use non-critical networking or non-critical storage. So if it goes down or we accept the risk that it might go down and lose the storage. But in the production, we have a different network. A lot of people try and what this does is that recognizes that there are multiple types of networks in a data center and I should engineer my networks for each use case. So if I need this sub-millisecond convergence with the magic, you know, no data lost no matter what happens, then maybe you should build a specific set of network devices just to support that feature. But over here, you can have a different type of network with much lower cost equipment, much lower tolerance, you know, different configurations, ease of use maybe, and that's used for different things. It's not a requirement to make a data center one big flat, you know, one big flat network that works for every single use case, because you end up with a network that's so complicated that you can't maintain it. Maybe it's better to take the complexity of a storage network and try and restrict that down to a certain place. Now, you have to have a data center of a certain size, and you also have to have the business sign off on the risk, but that's a different way of solving this problem and getting the same outcome.
So, Greg, I would piggyback off that and say, you know, as a network engineer, if you're designing and you're dealing with storage, one thing that's really useful to do is network engineers from an application perspective, we tend to say, okay, the traffic comes into the data center here, it goes to a VM over there or across this set of servers, blah, blah, blah. We don't really think through the storage path as well, right? The traffic gets to the VM, and now the VM does what with that information, right? You hit some other server, and then that server does what? Sometimes it's useful just to take just to sit down on a whiteboard and just do, this is the day in the life of a packet in my data center, and try to understand what that looks like. And then, Greg, you might find out, you go, well, you know what? This application, I need this for, and that application I need that for, and guess what? It's really hard to design for both of those. Maybe I should just segregate things off and do something different here.
I was reading a book recently, which this is going to get a little bit off the storage topic a little bit, but it's very relevant to what we're saying. There's a thing in the industry called T-skilling, where your skills are actually, most networking people are what we call I-skill, which is very deep in a single topic. You're really good at networking. But what the industry really wants, what the best groups or the best teams are built of people who have T skills, which means they've got a very broad set of skills across a wide range of topics and then very deep in one. So you have this T shape where your skill set's very wide across, you know, a bit of programming, you know, a bit of storage, you know, a bit of VMware, you know, a little bit of business. So when the business person says something, you understand a little bit of accounting, so you understand the purchasing department. But your real skill is down the middle. So As a networking person, you need to think about having T skills, so you understand that when you know people like Chris Weil start making weird noises about VIFs and LIFs, and the storage guy makes grunty noises about SCSI and you know LUNs, you should be able to have some sort of comprehension of those so that your network can add value to those discussions. And I just started thinking of it as a result of this book by Scott Burkun called A Year of Living Without Pants. It's a great book. It's really easy to read. It only took a couple of hours. But he talks about a T-skilling in there, and I found that really profound.
I thought it might be your autobiography there, Greg.
Well, he is in a hotel.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting pretty close to needing to wrap this up here. And Jay, I wanted to ask you, so this is where you, what you live and breathe is storage. Is there any one right way to do storage that we should all be heading to? Or where are we really at in the industry now?
Yes, my way.
Not quite the answer you're expecting, Ethan.
No, I think that if you look at the landscape overall, I think what's happening is that you wind up with an awful lot of choices, and sometimes choices can be good and sometimes choices can be bad. But at least you're not going to be locked into any one particular solution for whatever you're looking to do. It means you're going to have to do a little homework, but ultimately you do have the ability to choose from any number of possible solutions to give you the best results.
Options are good. And so right, then there is no one right way. It's understand your business model, understand your applications and what you're trying to achieve, and then let the technology be driven by those things rather than the other way around.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I would underline probably the best way if you were to distill it is whatever both meets the needs of the business and is simple. Like often I find designs that are just so heinously complex and try to, I guess, impress people with how things are widgeted and plugged in together that at the end of the day, it's almost impossible to troubleshoot. So I think as you're using these new tools like FCOE, iSCSI, not a new tool, but you have these tools in your tool belt, at the end of the day, if you've met the business need and you've done it in a simplistic way that's easy to communicate and grow, it's probably a pretty good design.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on right there. And I'll tell you what, why don't we go around the table real quick and give you guys a chance to plug your blogs, your Twitter handles, books you're writing, places you're going to speak, anything that interests you, and then we'll wrap it up. And Mr. Chris Weil, let's start with you.
All right. My blog is wahlnetwork.com. Again, it's wahlnetwork.com. My book, Networking for VMware Admins, comes out late March, early April, something like that. You can also find me on Pluralsight. I teach courses on the Cisco Certified Network Associate Data Center exam, and I'm on Twitter at Chris Weil.
Thanks for joining us, and I'm sure it won't be your last time on the show. And, of course, you're also on VPaaS, the Virtualization Podcast as a Service, right?
Oh, yeah, and I love that you said that because I typically feel shy saying the VPaaS part because it comes out slightly W'd. So.
VUPAAS. If you Google that, come up with Chris Weil and GS and Josh Atwell chatting about all things virtualization. Great, very practical podcast that I've been following. And Jay Metz, thank you for joining us on Packet Pushers. And same thing, man. How can folks follow you?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jay Metz, DrJMETZ. And I guess the best way to find my blog, unfortunately, the URL is kind of convoluted. It's just to type in Google or Bing or whatever your favorite search engine is, JMetz blog, if you're really, really, really bored.
Very good. And Russ, thanks as always for coming on the show.
Sure. At Routing Geek, and I blog most of the time at Packet Pushers. I'm kind of uni-blogging at this point. I don't really have any other places to blog. You can feel sorry for me now, but
it's the best place to blog. Everybody can find you there.
That's right.
And it's seen by a lot of people.
Oh, well, good. And anyway, I do have a new book coming out, but everybody's heard about this. So why am I talking about it yet again? But I am talking to Pearson about the next book. See, that's always the way it is with me.
Yeah, and the book that Russ was talking about is The Art of Network Architecture, which by the time you've heard this podcast, you should have also heard the podcast where we talked to Russ and co-author Denise Donahue about that book and what is in it. And Mr. Farrow, of course.
Yeah, I wanted to plug a couple of things. One of the things is that this show is sponsorable. So if you're a vendor and you'd like to get a message, these shows, we are open to taking 60 to 90 second plugs where we promote your product or your company. And also we have an email list where Packet Pushers supporters, we have a subscription so that you can get all the latest information about what's been posted on the Packet Pushers blogs, which, you know, it's a good way of you getting an email at the end of the week to say all the fantastic blog posts that people from the community have written. There's a particularly good one this week, two of them this week. One is from Willard Dennis, who posted about his first experiences with Cumulus Linux, which is really, really popular. And one other was the blogger from Japan. Oh, I'm so sorry. Can't think of his name, but he wrote a one-liner on Linux on how to block NTP reflection attacks using IP tables. Those two, you could get that delivered to your email box. So please try that in. And, of course, we've got some new podcasts on the Packet Pushers Network, Mr. Banks. We have the Coffee Break, which is me and Andrew Conry Murray talking about industry stuff. So all of those good things are happening on Packet Pushers and more to come.
The other podcast channel that you're talking about there, of course, is the Community Channel, where if you want to try your hand at podcasting, but you don't want to go to all the headache of building a podcast platform and a content delivery network and all that good stuff. Hey, we did all the hard stuff for you. All you got to do is generate some audio and we'll help you get it posted to our site in a very straightforward and easy way. And if you really like the whole podcasting thing and you keep generating content, well, we'll make a channel for you with your show, because if you're that awesome, we'd like to help you do that and launch your internet fame. So the community channel is there for you, and you can ping packetpushers@gmail.com if that interests you.
That's right. And, you know, so many people asked us, how do you do podcasting? We thought the best way was just to say, come and join us, get involved, and have a go. And but this way you can produce a couple of shows, share it with the community, and then if there's enough, if you're good at it and everybody likes it, then we'll make it happen for you.
And Greg's blog is etherealmind.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at etherealmind. My blog is ethancbanks.com. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks. And this, of course, has been the Packet Pushers podcast. Home base for us is packetpushers.net, where you can find the community blog and podcasts and all the rest of our content right from there with RSS feeds and all the rest. And we'd appreciate any email feedback you have, packetpushers@gmail.com. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.